This is exclusive access into the heart of racing. The Racing Pulse Inner Sanctum.
Yes, time for the Inner Sanctum, one of my favourite segments on Racing Pulse, whether I'm hosting or Felgate or Matty Stewart or whoever happens to be in the chair, because we get to spend a little bit more time with some of the participants of our great sport that are perhaps doing things a little bit differently. And one of those is, without doubt, trainer Michael Hibbs, who joins us this morning. Michael, welcome to the Inner Sanctum.
Good morning.
Is this your first crack in a sanctum?
Absolutely.
What is a sanctum anyway? That's not why we've got you here, but maybe we'll talk about that during the break. I'm not really sure. It sounds good though, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds impressive.
Very impressive, doesn't it? Very impressive. And I'll tell you what's impressive. And before we get into your bloodstock work, most punters would remember you, of course, from group winners like Minson and Volatont and stakes performers like Light Express. And you always seem to have a good horse in your stable, despite not having overly big numbers. And perhaps we're learning a little bit about why you've been able to manage to do that throughout your career through Peregrine Bloodstock, a pedigree analysis business you've started.
Yeah, look, I suppose over the last couple of years, it really come as a light bulb moment for me in regards to looking at pedigrees from a different angle. And over the years, I've always loved the pedigrees and the idea, coupled with a lot of other things, and we've been able to buy horses over the years from a lower scale that have performed quite well. So we've been pretty lucky in that. But what I've found since I've come up with those ideas is that I was probably pretty lucky to be able to purchase those horses.
So what prompted you to start thinking more deeply, I guess, about the impact of pedigree in certain matings and the success of those matings on the actual racehorse? Was it that self-analysis of your former stars?
I think you really do have to look at how you go about things and how you can improve your situation. And I felt I was passionate about how looking at how pedigrees work and what works, and I've always had a bit of a formula with the sire, but I've broadened that expanse, and since I've done an analysis, the results have been remarkable, really.
Yeah, I bumped into you at Sydney at the Easter sale earlier in the year, and we got talking about what you're up to, and when you showed me a little bit about what you do, it is very in-depth. There's some serious analysis that goes into this. It's time-consuming, and it really is a skill to learn. What have you noticed? What are some of the things you've noticed about not only the impact of certain matings, but the importance of pedigree over, say, type, which you hear, at sales time, so many buyers saying, oh, we bought it on type. It was a lovely type, great physical specimen.
Look, I understand completely what they're saying in regards to that, because I've done the same. And over the years, I've bought types that actually haven't gone to the races and done too much. And I'm sure everybody out there has done exactly the same. But what I say in regards to that is certainly if you have a look at them on type and they tick all the boxes, if we have a look at what gets presented to us when we go to the sales, it's a catalogue. If everybody was just buying on type, then why don't we just walk around and just look at the horses and not worry about what's in the catalogue? And the catalogue's actually full of pedigrees for a reason. So I strongly believe if we can find something that works in regards to a pedigree, and then it works with the type and ticks all the other boxes, isn't that a better place to be than just buying them on type?
Yeah, certainly. If you can have both sides of the coin, it's a great result. When you've been going around sales and talking to fellow trainers or other buyers about what you're doing, what's the response been? Have they had similar light bulb moments, or have you had trainers saying to you, "Oh, yeah, actually, I always wondered why, Tabletop was such a good racehorse. I could never really put my finger on it. It was only just a type."
I suppose a lot of people that I've spoken to, especially trainers in the industry, they look at type, and like me years ago, you don't have enough time to be able to spend the time on looking at what works and from a pedigree perspective and why it works. The thing is that I've looked at over the last couple of years is every year I do this analysis, you turn up gems that people don't actually realise that are gems, and that's what's exciting for me, and I'm passionate about it, and to be able to pass on that information to my clients is great.
So how are you actually assessing, say, a yearling catalogue? Are you ranking them on points? Are you ranking them on the success of matings or nicks? Or how, what, without giving your absolute formula away, how do you sort the good from the bad?
Well, I suppose there's no... When you say good from bad, sometimes horses come from anywhere, and usually a lot of the elite race horses don't have fantastic pedigrees, but they're just genetic freaks, and there's something, they're horses that are going to slip through anyway. But I look at stuff that works. So I want to provide people with a chance for them to be able to get an elite racehorse. And for them to be able to do that, they need to cut their odds down. And if they cut their odds down by looking at a pedigree that works, and as I said, they look at a type and they love the type and the x-rays work and everything falls into place for them, well, that's the horse that they should be buying. Because more or less, if you see what I've been seeing, is that the elite size keep being elite. And there's also elite size that are up-and-coming elite size, which are actually buyable at a lower end of the market.
Well, what you say about elite size continuing to be elite, when you pointed out to me More Than Ready, who was a horse that perhaps this season, you know, the market might have had a school of thought that he was getting a bit older, and perhaps, you know, a few of his yearlings being sold weren't reaching the service fee that he'd served those mares at, and maybe the stallion's coming to the end of it. But as you pointed out, his statistics are continually fantastic. Can you just tell us a little bit about More Than Ready and why he's been such a success?
Well, I think he's been a phenomenon over a lot of years, and he's probably been the main shuttler that we've had. I think he's up to his 17th year of shuttling from America. And, you know, I had one comment when we were talking about More Than Ready when I was at the sales of I don't like the way More Than Ready looks. And I said, I'm not sure what you don't like. He's had 175 stakes winners. And
you can overlook something on
probably,
that basis.
Probably looks don't mean a hell of a lot. But then when we talk, as an example for More Than Ready, he had 175 stakes winners, and he's now got 180 stakes winners.
Yeah.
So he's had 5 stakes winners since we've spoken. So is he still going okay, or is he going backwards? And when we're talking about stats, he's in the elite category. He really is.
Why does he work so well in Australia?
I think a lot of the time he's done really well with, and I think we've had this conversation, his best nick is Dane Hill.
Mm. And when you say nick, just for people that aren't sort of up on the pedigree side of things, can you just explain what a nick is?
Well, what they call a nick is a situation where a stallion mating to a broodmare, and that's what they call a nick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, More Than Ready is out of Dane Hill mares, so each mare that has gone to More Than Ready would be by Dane Hill,
mm-hmm.
And their bottom side pedigree would be different. But at the moment, More Than Ready, as an example, has got 15 stakes winners and 15 stakes splinters with that Dane Hill cross, which is an unbelievable nick.
Wow. So. And the longevity of a horse like More Than Ready, and you mentioned how many years he's been shuttling, is that particularly unusual, or is that a fact common to these elite sires that they can keep producing stakes winners year in, year out?
Well, they seem to. They keep becoming elite like horses. And look, I know they get a lot of good mares, but More Than Ready, Fastnet Rock, Snitzel, Sebring, they just keep doing it every year. High Chaparral. Now, High Chaparral's dead, and he's had a Group 1 winner this year. He's done an extraordinary job. So they keep being elite, and they keep, as long as they keep being bred correctly, there's no reason why they shouldn't be.
How much of the market do you think breeds to sell for a commercial result, and how much of the market do you think actually spends the time working on finding the right mating that'll give them the best chance of producing a top-class racehorse?
Well, look, I think that's a good question. It's probably a hard question to answer. Like, everybody wants to make a quid. I don't think there's any doubt about that. If they want to look at a striving for an elite racehorse, then I think they need to be a little bit more they need to study a little bit more to try and be able to achieve that, because what I do is try and cut my client's odds down of being able to find one of those, and I think that's a good thing.
Do you look at breeders like, say, Rick Jamieson? We look at the terrific result realised by Jamaica yesterday in the sale, and Rick's renowned in Victoria for planning his matings very, very carefully, and his output from his farm of stakes winners has been really remarkable in a relatively short space of time. Do you ever analyse sort of those matings and look and try and work out the formula of other successful breeders?
I haven't really had a great look at what he does. I have a great understanding that he's a great breeder, and he obviously takes the time to have a look at what works, and he's had great success with it, and that's fantastic. But I look at it from a purely stats point of view, and as we've discussed previously, stats don't lie. And if you look at stuff that works, then it seems to continue to work as long as you've got the right product.
A question just came in off the SMS here on the back of our More Than Ready conversation in Shuttlestones, is that, you know, there's so many Shuttlestones that are so good that maybe do really well in one hemisphere and not so much here. And a great example of that is Galileo. Why do you think some Shuttlestones don't have the success in one hemisphere as they do in the other?
I think it probably depends on what their optimum distances are.
Mm.
And in Australia, we don't seem to have as much patience for the staying horses as we do for the sprinting horses. We like the quick, precocious horses that give a quick return. Galileo, for instance, is a great example of patience. You know, his horses obviously require a bit of patience. They might work better in the softer ground. He himself came over to Australia and shuttled for a couple of years, Galileo, and wasn't that successful. But I'm not really sure whether he was probably, their progeny was handled as well as what they could be. He had a couple of decent horses, but nothing to the success that he's had overseas. But I still think he's not done yet. I think you'll see some of his sons in Australia. I think it's exciting times for Galileo in Australia, really.
It's a really interesting, observation watching Frankel now as well. Not that he's shuttling to Australia, but a lot of the bigger breeders are bringing out mares or foals that they've bought by Frankel to Australia, or Australian mares they've sent up there to be served at Southern Hemisphere time. You know, he's doing such a great job in Europe, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the Australian broodmare band will be as successful with him.
No, but I think again, as long as they breed correctly to him, then I think they'll have a great opportunity to have very nice horses here in Australia too, and I think that's the key. If we have a look at what's happened with Galileo, his best nick in Australia from Galileo mares is Fastnet Rock. Like, he's got 16 stakes winners out of Galileo mares, and a lot of the time we reverse that. So when we bring a Galileo stand out there, he obviously works well with Fastnet Rock or the Danehill line, and I think that's what I think is going to happen in the future. And there's a horse that they're just bringing out this year that's free of Danehill, and I think he'll be a star. I think.
Well, it becomes so important in a jurisdiction like Australia, doesn't it? When there is such a dominant force like the Danehill line, and then it's continued on through Fastnet, you have to try and find that outcross that capitalises not only on that strength and that quality, but adds to it.
Yeah, I think what you're finding, and there's been a huge upsurge in outcrosses in the last couple of years, and horses that have done really well, like Written Tycoon. He's a complete outcross. Northern Meteor was, now he's so you're seeing those horses come to prevalence. Deep Impact Stand's starting to come out now. Toes and Stardom, I'm Invincible is a complete outcross. So they've been so successful because they've been able to mix well with that blood, and that's been a boon for Australian breeding and racing.
It absolutely is. It's fascinating stuff, Michael. I'm looking forward to, after the break, to picking your brain a bit about a couple of the first season sires this year, and a couple that you might think will go on and kick, and maybe a horse like Spirit of Boom as to why he's been so successful and made such an impact on the industry in a short amount of time. You're listening to Racing Pulse. This is the Inner Sanctum with Michael Hibbs and Mick Sharkey. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to the Inner Sanctum. We're joined by Michael Hibbs, who's you're still training though, aren't you? Michael somebody texted in and said he's still got horses. I think I saw he had a winner the other day. He hasn't fully gone to the dark side of bloodstock.
No, we've had a reasonable year really, but you know, we've got average horses and we've trained a few winners, so it's been okay.
How many in work at the moment?
Just working eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've never really had a huge team, have you?
No.
Throughout your career?
No, I've never been able to achieve big numbers, but I've always felt we've had pretty good success with the horses that we've had.
Yeah, your strike rate's been good, particularly when it's come to group races, but maybe the success that you'll be able to help other trainers and other buyers through Peregrine Bloodstock will be a more satisfying legacy to put people onto group winners in coming years. We talked about the analysis and how you go about identifying horses with potential on pedigree to go and be really good performers through nicks and the like. How do you then assess your results? I guess it's all well and good grabbing a catalogue and saying, well, this horse nicks well, oh, this is a great cross. But when they've actually gone to the races, what are you seeing in your results?
Look, I'm probably a standard really with how the results have, and I've only really started to look at the results, I think, from the start of April, the main meeting in Sydney where it was the Australian Oaks.
And, so this is from yearling sales 18 months ago?
Yeah, so
two years ago?
I've really just started to do the analysis from 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I'd better start having a look and seeing how the results are going in regards to it. And I think on that day, I was pretty astounded. I was really confident that it would work. But I suppose when I looked at the Australian Oaks, and 8 of the 13 had an A or a B in my classification,
wow,
it was really a revelation for me. And on that day, I think I had 4 other winners with an A or B classification, and that was on one of the main days of the year. So it really confirmed to me that I was on the right track.
Yeah.
And I think since then, the results keep coming, which is fantastic.
So where do you grade down to? Is it A, B, C, or do you get down to G and et cetera?
No, it's really...
There's no Zs, are there?
No, it's really only a 3-pong attack that I've got.
Okay.
And to get an A, you really have to have all 3 in place. But a B is still quite good too, because it has 2 elite categories out of the 3.
And with that example of the Oaks, going back and looking at those the field last night and looking what they sold for, they were spread all over the range. We're not just talking about horses that were, you know, 6-figure yearlings. There were horses there for, you know, 40 and 50,000 that were able to make the Oaks field. So it's a great sign for you as well when you're working with trainers and buyers. There's value to be found and elite ratings to be found all over the market.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, if my systems can couple with what people are doing, I think it's just an extra tool for them to be able to make a more informed decision. There's a lot of people out there that go on a whim, and there's a lot of first seasons size out there. The facts are 90% of them don't make it.
Mm.
Now, I'd rather be putting people into horses at work rather than horses that we think are going to work. And you can get lucky, but a lot of the time it doesn't happen.
It's quite timely that we're having this chat, given that at this time of year, so many breeders, and you know, whether they're large or small, are beginning to look at stallion opportunities to send their mares to for the start of this season on September 1st. Looking at the established size that we have in Australia at the moment, could you maybe give a couple of your favourites that you think are generally pretty consistent, and maybe a couple of the better crosses that seem to work well for them?
In regards to the elite size you're talking
about? Yeah, the elite size, the ones we know, before we sort of have a chat about the newer stallions.
Yeah, I think, honestly, you can't go past the big guns. Like, mm. You know, Snitzel's had an absolutely stellar year.
Mm.
And I remember saying to John Massaro when he had his first season, I actually bought Snitzel in his first season and his second season,
mm.
And now I can't buy them. So. But I did say to him, I believe he'll be the best reduced choice stand that... that's produced, because he had everything.
Yeah.
Like, he had racetrack performance. He was a good 2-year-old, but he was a better 3-year-old. He won an Oakley Plate at 3. He ran second to the to the best sprinter in the world at the time, Takeover Target and the Newmarket Handicap. They're two of the hardest sprint races to win.
Mm.
And to perform that well as a three-year-old, that just shows you his absolute quality. He was by a great stand out of a great dam side. And he was a type of horse that really suits Australia because he wasn't huge. He was a neat, fast-going type, and that's what he's produced in Australia. So he was a perfect option for breeders, and that's probably why he's turned out so well.
So he's well and truly, obviously, Schnitzel at the top of the tree. Is there an emerging stallion that you've noticed in the last 12 months? You think, you know what, he still represents value, but he's doing a great job.
Oh, look, I think, and I keep talking about Dream Ahead.
Yeah.
When we look at Dream Ahead stats, he's got 170 winners for 16 stakes winners, and you know the question that I get all the time: well, what's happened to his? It's all European stuff.
Mm.
Well, his actual best nick is at a Redditch Choice mares. He's had four
is
of the
really?
Races for four stakes winners, and his third best nick is at a Hassanay mares. So
there's plenty of them here too.
Yeah. So he's a horse that you can actually get for not a lot of money.
Mm.
But when you're looking at horses like Fastnet Rock and, Sebring, and they're quality horses that keep, and as long as they're bred correctly, and that's the key to it, you'll find that you should keep having ongoing success.
I wanted to ask you about Spirit of Boom. He's been a revelation, I guess, this season in terms of his success. And he seems to have left stakes winners across all sorts of mares. When you're looking at a first-season sire like that that's done quite well, how early can you start to predict the patterns that might, you know, long-term play out to be a really strong nick?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure whether anybody could have would have actually predicted that Spirit of Boom would have turned out to be the way he is. A phenomenal racehorse over a lot of years, which is not usual in the Australian industry now. They give him two or three or five starts and then they send him off to stud. He had four seasons at the elite level. He's by a stand that hasn't really produced a great amount of stakes winners to winners. But he was such a great racehorse himself. But I think it's a product that he's left on the ground that's made all the difference. When you go and have a look at him, they all look the same. He seems to be prepotent. They're short-coupled, great hind end, early-going type of horses, obviously with a great brain. Because in Australia, if horses are trainable, they're the ones that make the best stand. The ones that, you know, temperament comes into it. It's very important as well. And obviously those horses have got great temperaments. Otherwise, he wouldn't have produced 16 individual winners like he has this year.
Yeah, dead right. It'll be fascinating to watch his progression as well going forward from that point. Just a text come through on social media saying, why stakes winners to winners? Isn't stakes winners to runners a better measure?
Well, this is probably where I differ from a lot of people. And when we talk about stakes winners to winners, I can go to the sales and each trainer can go to the sales and buy a winner.
Mm.
And I'm sure they've done that. So I'm going there to look at a horse that's got great confirmation. It ticks all the boxes from that point of view. And trainers will want to go and do that because that's what they buy on type. So then they do all their checks and balances and that's the horse that they buy. So they're... we're trying to cut our rods down by buying an elite racehorse. If I can buy a winner, and I'm very confident that I can, then if I'm buying from an elite stand, I'm a better... if that horse wins a race, I'm a 1 in 10 chance of winning a stakes race, and I like those odds.
Yeah, those odds are pretty handy, aren't they? Most people that like an each-way bet on a Saturday take 10 to 1.
Because you'll also find that if you're talking about runners, that not all of them are going to tick the boxes for you. So they're not the horses that you're going to buy, whether they've got crooked legs or they're backward or they don't have a great temperament. There's all this stuff that comes into play as well. So when you go to the sales, if you get with a professional that you trust, and they can show you a horse with temperament, they can show you a pedigree, and they can show you all the other thing that ticks the boxes, well, that's probably the place that you need to be.
Mm. Michael, it seems you've piqued the interest of a few listeners. Somebody's asked, what is the name of the stallion free of Danehill coming to Australia that Michael suggested would work well, please? Somebody's keen.
Absolutely. They do a great job, and I think, you know, we're looking at a horse like Churchill, and I think he represents excellent value. He's 27,500, and I'm not, I don't get any kickback from Cornwall, but when you look at what Churchill's done, he's by Galileo out of a Stormcat mare.
Yeah.
Now, if I was rating him, which I can do in the Northern Hemisphere too, which I'm excited about doing this year, and I've actually got a client in the Northern Hemisphere that I'm actually going to do the yearling books for, which I'm really excited about, is that he would have been an A in my classification.
Yeah.
You know, he's buying an elite sire out of an elite broodmare sire, and there's already something that works. He's free of Danehill, which is very important going forward, and that's, I think, the reason why Cornwall's brought him out, because they've got all their Fastnet Rock horses.
Yeah.
But when you look at Galileo, for instance, like Fastnet Rock out of Galileo Mares has produced 50 winners for 16 stakes winners and 6 stakes place getters. That's 22 stakes horses from 50 winners. That's unbelievable,
it's a pretty good ratio,
stat,
isn't it?
Unbelievable stat. But when you look at Galileo, his best nick is Danehill, Darshan, Danehill Dancer, Pivotal. We've got Danehill Mares here, Danehill Dancer Mares here, Rainbow Quest. There's a littery of mares that could go to this stand that actually could be successful. And these, when I'm talking about elite broodmare size. So,
Michael, it's fascinating stuff, and I could keep talking to you and picking your brain for hours. Thank you so much for coming into the Inner Sanctum this morning and sharing a bit of that knowledge. And judging by the feedback we've had, we've got a few people that have might be starting to think a little bit differently about how they plan their matings this year. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Mick, and I appreciate your time.
No worries at all. Mick Hibbs there, trainer? I think we'll be hearing a lot more about Peregrine Bloodstock and the great work that organisation does in coming season.